Hope you can read this writing.
Culvery. Outside, or it's very cold outside. In Indian, you don't have a lot of unnecessary words for if. I think the way Norman did it before, he had it about like that, and I think it'll pick up. You know, I think it's sensitive. Well, that's how you write this. Now at MIT, this professor would ask me how to say a word in Indian, and I would say the word, and then he would repeat the word. If it didn't sound right to me, I would have him repeat it again. And then when the word finally sounded right, then he would write this word down. We had another man there at MIT who was learning this, who was from Finland. So he spoke Finnish, and sometimes some of the sounds in Catawba were a little difficult for him. But whereas Dr. Matthews maybe would have to say the word three times, this man from Finland might have to say it six times. So, you know, the mornings used to fly pretty fast until finally they picked up the sounds. They made some taping also of the language, and they are comparing. See, the Catawba language belongs to an Indian language group, which is called Siouan, S-I-O-U-A-N. The Siouan language is a language that the Catawba language comes from. Now, other tribes that speak languages related to this Siouan language, well, up at Catawba first. The Osage. Another tribe probably that you've never heard of, the Tutelo. The Winnebago. Quapaw. The Sioux. Another tribe that you probably never heard of, these people don't survive today, the Saponi. These people all speak Siouan languages. They are trying to determine how close Catawba is to Sioux. Now, of course, Sioux is a language still spoken by, I think at least 38,000 people in North and South Dakota speak Sioux. There are certain words in Catawba and Sioux that are much closer than most linguists ever believed. Found out that the word for three in Catawba is numnare, and three in Sioux is yumnare. This is very close. The word for girl in Sioux is waychencha, and the word for child in Catawba is yincha. So this is fairly close too. Now, in other words, they're way off. If you say buffalo in Sioux, you say tatanka. In Catawba, it's yudahas. This is completely different. But these languages are all related, only so that a linguist could see where the relationship exists. Now, this language is spoken in Oklahoma by about 2,000 people. The Tutelo Indians were another tribe from North Carolina, and they used to fight with the Catawbas. And they left North Carolina and were invited to live among the Cayuga Indians up in Ontario, Canada. They moved up there, I think, in 1700, up with the Cayugas, and they live up with the Cayugas today. Now, there are no people speaking Tutelo today, but the Tutelo, what has happened among the Tutelo, for example, every time a Tutelo died, The Tutelo would give that, would want to pick someone to take that person's name to carry on through life. So they have a ceremony called Tutelo's Spirit Adoption Ceremony. And when a Tutelo dies, that name is given to another person, and that person carries the identity of the deceased. And this way, there'll always be somebody around who will carry the name of Tutelo. There are perhaps still 200 direct Tutelo descendants among the Cayuga in Canada. Some of them, of course, have intermarried. They may be part Tutelo and part Cayuga, part Tutelo and part Mohawk, part Tutelo, Mohawk, Seneca, and Tuscarora. But they have preserved some of the songs of the Tutelo, but not the language. Winnebago is still spoken by about close to 2,000 people in Wisconsin and Nebraska. And Quapaw is spoken by maybe 100 people in Oklahoma. And Saponi is, this group is extinct as a tribe. They perhaps merged with other tribes. But the linguists are interested in, like I said, in preserving this language for the future. Because, you know, you can never tell how long a person is going to be around. So they have completed the recording of the language at MIT.
Could you tell about, in general, the work that's going on there, and all these different people from different countries that are recording there?
Yes, well, MIT has a an excellent linguistics department, so much so now that there's a big feud going on between MIT, Harvard, and Yale, because Harvard and Yale formerly were tops in linguistics. But MIT is a technological institute. They really have really gone into linguistics in a big way and disproven a lot of theories. Now, I met people up there who spoke languages, African languages, Welsh, Turkish, Greek, Albanian, Chinese, and Japanese. it was always interesting to notice that when the Chinese informants would be talking Chinese, they would disagree about how a word was said. One fellow said, "No, that's not the way you say that." The fellow said, "Sure it is, that's right. This is how you say this word." And the other Chinese would say, "No, you're wrong, you don't say it that way at all." And they would get into real violent arguments. And the Japanese also would disagree, but they went about it in a different manner. The Japanese informant would say, "Well, you say, we say this so-and-so." And the other fellow, he would bow and say, "I'm very sorry, but you don't say it that way. We say it this way." And the other fellow would say, "Well, I'm sorry to inform you that you're wrong, but it's not said that way." And it was really interesting to notice the different patterns in behavior, but they were always very extremely polite in correcting each other.
Were there other Indians there?
They had a Mi'kmaq there, it was too quiet for him there. He said, "I can't work in this place." He said, "If you want to come down to the bar room, if I have a glass of beer in front of me, I'll be much more relaxed." And they found, because this was a little out of the ordinary, but Mi'kmaq is being reported now. But a fellow, one of the students, went to Canada and spent a summer with the Mi'kmaq family, and he came back speaking good Mi'kmaq. Then they had Mohawks there, but I didn't meet any other Indians there.
Would you tell about how you wanted to work outdoors?
Oh yes, when I went in the office there the first week, you know, I would sit down and Dr. Matthew, and there was a blackboard, and the room was sort of drab looking, and he'd say, "How do you say bear?" And I'd say, "Bear." "How do you say this?" And I'd say it. So I said, "Is it possible for us to go out of doors?" So he said, "Why?" I said, "Well, out of doors, I think I'd be more inspired and perhaps remember more things, because in here I don't see any books and a desk and a telephone, and these things don't bring back to mind any particular things. We go out of doors, we'll see birds, we'll see this and that." So Dr. Matthews said, "No," he said, "I make up my mind when I walk through that door, this is where I do business. This is, I'm here to work." And he said, "I don't have any problem with doing any work in here at all." So he said, "And besides, my students would think it rather strange if I were to go out and sit down on the grass."
Rather dignified man, is he?
A young man. He's Yes, he is, but he's a lot of fun when he's out of school. But he would never think of wearing a sport jacket. He's that type of fellow. He always wears a suit. And he used to be in there with a suit and me in my red shirt and my moccasins and beaded belt. But the Finnish boy used to be very casual. They noticed this among certain students at MIT, that there were certain students who just wouldn't. It seemed that the Africans and the Orientals and the Hindus would always have the suit and white tie. And the French and the Italians would have the open shirts and shorts. I never saw an Oriental in shorts, an Oriental man in shorts. But getting back to that, the following day, Dr. Matthews didn't come in. So the Finnish student said to me, he said, look, I kind of like that idea of going outside. So if you want to go out under the trees, it's all right with me. So we went out of doors and we sat down under the trees. And I think I just laid down flat on my back and sort of looked up at the sky. And I would see a bird fly by and I'd say, well, that's this, or this is this. I identified trees. So the next morning when Dr. Matthews came in, he said, Paul, what did you get done yesterday? So he showed him a list. So he said, you got all right yesterday? He said, yeah. He said, gee, that's great. So Paul said, yeah, we got it outside. So he said, well, he said, where do I get my hat and coat? So he went outside with the student. It's true that every one of his students come on and say, gee, you know, what are you doing over here, Dr. Matthews? He's sitting under the tree. He had his coat off. He was relaxed. He said, gee, I've never done this before in my life. But it was better, really, working outdoors and recalling more things.
Would you put down a sentence in Indian and the translation under it so we could see a sentence structure?
Yeah. There's one. Oh, there's that.
Is that a complete sentence?
Yes. It's very cold outside. But there's no it's there. The it is is understood.
Oh, I guess you've gone through this already before I came.
That's all right, I don't mind. I can show you actually the shortest word in Katona and also the longest. This is the shortest word in the Katona language, et, which is a curl. The longest word surface of the skin, but the other languages, Indian languages, as I say, they're all quite different now. Wampanoag, if I had known that we have the Lord's Prayer, it's been recorded in Wampanoag, there's one man who knows it, but it's very rapid. It's this is the way that sounds. But Catawba is, this is Nimit Nimit Hayahak, it's or an eruption on the surface of the skin.
Could you give us a sentence now?
In Katawa?
Yeah.
Yeah. Danire yincha yakini hukin tsuk. I see all of the children and the teachers here in the room.
Or, but how would the word, what is the word order? I was interested in the word order.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
No, I didn't do that.
Tshaba never had a written language, did they?
No, I learned to write phonetically from Dr. Speck of the University of Pennsylvania. School. But this is the way it's written. You would never write it like we are in the school.
Say that last word is we are.
Yes, hiha.
How would you say I am?
Dire. And words like, for example, this was a hard thing for me when I first when they started conjugating verbs, well, that was really hard because I have not spoken this language with anyone since my cousin was killed in 1952. So he's the last one that I spoke Indian with. And they asked me, I know they said, how do you say kill? So I said, cooperate. And then I kill. And then you kill. And then we kill. And I just couldn't think, it was hard. Then he asked me the word for butter. I couldn't think of that. And where I was staying, I was laying in my bed. And I said, Nyankre. The fellow next to me jumped. He said, what's the matter with you? I said, butter. He said, butter what? I said, that's a word for butter that they asked me. I couldn't remember. You see, it came to me. Sometimes they'd ask me a word, and I couldn't think of the word then, but I would think of another word that they might have asked me 2 days ago, too. But I want to show you how, this is a word for kill. I'm dividing these up a little so it makes it a little easier. This is a word for kill, kofwankri.
That's the verb to kill?
Yes. Now, Digwari, I kill. Digwari. Digwari. You kill.
Does the verb always come at the end of the sentence?
Yes. Wakwari, they kill. Wakwari hakia, they shall not kill. It's, this is the way this is written. Now, for example, clever. Now, if you were to say the girl is clever, you would just say, you watch a hot pink TV, right? Girl, the clever is.
Now, could you tell us about your own relationship with the guitar? How do you happen to remember? Were you down there when you were a boy? Is that it?
Yes, I was. And not only that, but I spent a lot of time with my grandfather and with older people. And the other children used to make fun of me too. They used to call me Yantmunsi, which means old man, because I was always with old people. I played baseball and all the other games as well, but I just I just found that it was much better, and I learned a lot more just taking a walk through the woods with a couple of older men and learned hunting tricks and how to make traps, how to speak Indian, and all the things that I'm able to do today I learned from these older people. So that when I, as I explained before you were here, when I went out to East Hampton to live, I talked to myself. And then my cousin would come down in the summertime, and then we would, you know, we would talk together. But I remember probably once in camp, they had color war, and each team picked one of us for color war. I think I was on the white team, he was on the blue team. And so they asked me some slogans in Catawba. And so when they came into the dining room, we had all these slogans in Catawba. But my cousin couldn't read Catawba. And they'd say to him, "What does that mean?" And he'd say, "I don't know." So at night, even, you know, color war is horrible. We were living together in the same tent. And he said to me, "Jesus, that's a pretty dirty trick." He says, "Because you know I can't read Catawba, and you really put me at a disadvantage." But during the whole thing, there was this awful spirit of this competition, and he almost stopped speaking to me during Catawba. But he could speak it.
Well, now when you were a boy there, how were you taught the Catawba, to write the Catawba language?
Well, I wasn't taught there. I wasn't taught it. Nobody could write it. As a matter of fact, I'm sorry to say that all the people who spoke Catawba, and within my memory, the only one who could read and write even English was my grandfather. Our chief couldn't read or write.
I think that's pretty hard for people to conceive, that here are a group of people living and for centuries, and they had a language, but it was not written down.
Not written. And chief's sister couldn't write. Bob Harris could write. He could write English and read English, but he couldn't write Indian or read Indian. So what made it much easier at MIT for Dr. Matthews was the fact that I could read and write the language, and he could give me assignments. He'd ask me do two or three texts tonight, and you know, bring them in the morning. Anything, you know, hunting or what you've done.
Are you the only person that put down the Catawba there at MIT?
Yes.
How many words have you come through with?
Gee, Norman, I don't know, but it's a lot.
What does he do? Does he?
His card has every word indexed. Mm-hmm. And the next project we're going to do there is a dictionary. But he has all the words indexed alphabetically. And a number of texts. There are I think I did 12 texts. And like I say, because I'm familiar and can read and write it, he said it's just so easy to work with someone who can do that, because, you know, with Chief Blue, it was very hard breaking down things.
Now, in the East here, among the Indians, even though they speak English and they don't even know the Indian language in many cases, are there Indian expressions that they have?
Oh yes, there are expressions. I know in my own, in Catawba, there's a word that I use, and my other friends know it from different tribes. You know the expression people have today. This is, "Oh gee, that's cool." They say, "Yeah, that's real cheap." Which is cool or cold. And use the word hadahi for way out. You know, saying, "Gee, that's a way out storm or something." This is very hadahi. So the Mohawks and Senecas and other friends of mine, they know this. And they have expressions too. They also have expressions in English. Like a person who's who's thick headed, you call him a turtle head. Because the turtle has a pretty thick head. Just trying to think. Bashanipak is a word in the Narragansett language, which means refers to beer or wine or any type of alcohol. That's the one word that they've kept. They don't no longer speak it. But in the state of Maine, that's unique in the East, because Indian children in the state of Maine speak three languages: Indian, English, and French. At least the Passamaquoddies do. Oh yes, yeah. Passamaquoddies are very. There's an incident that happened to two little Passamaquoddy girls that came to New York to see their uncle and aunt who lived in Queens Village. And they had never been in the subway before. And they go to church on the reservation. When they came home, mother took them to Gimbel's. When they came home, their uncle said, "Where did you go today?" So the little girl, her name was Gerada, she said, "Oh, Uncle Bob," she said, "we went to hell." So he said, "What?" "Yeah, we went," and they speak English with a sort of an accent. She said, "Yeah, we went down on the ground." So her aunt said, "You know, they mean the subway," because they had heard in teachings in the church about when you go down the ground. But I thought that was very cute. Yeah, they really sincere. But they speak those three languages up there. In Rhode Island, they have some sentences in Indian that they still remember, but not the language. And no speaker in Rhode Island. There isn't one person who could speak. Massachusetts has just Russell Gardner, whom I told you had pneumonia and couldn't attend the funeral, and Leonard James. Those two can speak. Connecticut, the last speaker in Connecticut was Fidelia Fielding, who died in 1909, I believe. But they have erected a memorial to her in Fort Chantuck State Park near Norwich. It says in honor of Fidelia Fielding, the last speaker of the Mohegan language. In New York State, Mohawk is still spoken. Let's say between the Canadian and New York State Mohawks, about 7,000 people, probably 5,000 speakers. On Long Island, the last Shinnecock speaker died in 1915. Let's see, in South Carolina now, no speakers, just myself, and I'm not down there. In North Carolina, the Cherokees still speak. And of course in Florida, the Seminoles still speak.
Do you have any questions you'd like to ask?
Yes?
I was wondering how you learned the language from speaking with your elders, is that right?
Yeah.
But no one now has been willing to speak with you.
No, there's possibly, this we're going to investigate. You see, the Catawbas migrated to New Mexico and Utah in the 1880s, because they became Mormon converts. And there's a group out there in Farmington, New Mexico. There were two people, Sarah and Pinckney Head, who were still living in 1951, who spoke Catawba. But I'm sure they're dead by now. But they had children. And we're going to try and find out if there's anyone out there who speaks. Because if there is, and I could have a conversation with someone who spoke, then it would come back, a lot of it, just like that. There was a woman in California who spoke an Indian language, and it took the linguists 8 months before they could really get anything out of her. She had forgotten that much. Now the Shawnee in Oklahoma have made, the Shawnee, any Shawnee who records, Shawnee is killed. This is a, there, Dr. Voglin from the University of Indiana recorded Shawnee. And 2 weeks later, one of his Shawnee informants committed suicide, and the other one was very mysteriously killed. But they have a tribal vow, the Shawnee will not. Any Shawnee who does any, records anything Shawnee, they will really do them in. That's a modern Oklahoma tribe, but this is also an idea of how conservative the Shawnee are. They are very, very touchy on that. Very touchy. So, like I say, Vogelin hasn't even published his Shawnee. He's just got it in manuscript form. But this is what happened to his informants.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm just wondering if you know what tribe Chief Crow Cheese was of.
Yeah, he was a Chiricahua Apache. You see that on Broken Arrow?
Yeah. I know someone who's a great grand.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, Shawnee also, if you watch these Daniel Boone episodes, they have a lot of the Shawnee. They were really an Indian's Indian also, the Shawnee. They nobody ever really conquered them. The Iroquois tried to, but they were very, and a very mobile people. They used to just go all over. They'd go on war parties sometimes 2 or 3 years. Used to even bring back stories. They used to bring back stories of places that just had to be the West Coast when they talked about people living in the big wooden houses and spearing fish from falls. They are really traveling around.
Well,
are
they still control the people?
Oh, yes.
Speak English?
Yes, everybody speaks English.
And where do they live?
They live in South Carolina, those who live on the reservation. Another group lives in Rock Hill because the government now has built some homes, mill homes, near the mills, so they don't have to travel at 11 miles a day. There's another group in Farmington, New Mexico, and there's a group in Sanford, Colorado, Cedar City, Utah. Then groups of Catawbas migrated to Oklahoma, to the different tribes out there where they've merged with the Oklahoma groups. There's Catawbas incorporated as part of the Creek Nation in Chakota, Oklahoma. There's another group part of the Choctaw Nation in Stigler, Oklahoma. And some with the Chickasaws in Lindsay, Oklahoma. But these are not separate. They don't enumerate themselves separately as Catawba. They are Catawba and Chickasaw, or Catawba and Creek. But they preserve the tradition that, you know, that they are descended from the Catawba, now intermarried with the other groups.
One more thing I was wondering, can you tell us how you got your name? Was that
My name was given to me by my grandfather, and it was supposed to have been after this storm, because sometimes they don't give you a name until it becomes appropriate. And then in some tribes they used to give children names according to the characteristics. If a child was, if a child was cross, they'd never call it Dawn or Lily or anything like that. They would give it a name to indicate that. And then the child would try to change the characteristic. And then they have also names that are nicknames. Like there was a boy who was, he was kind of wide and used to sort of waddle along. They used to call him Urchikpo, which that was his nickname. It means toad. And then there was a woman who never stayed home. She was always visiting, and they called her Dugmanwe, means never stays home. And they have nicknames like that. And then you take a tribe like the Navajo. The Navajo will never tell you his real name. His real name is for himself and his family. And then he has another name that he's known by members of the tribe. And like tourists, a tourist will go up to Navajo and say, "What's your name?" And he'll just say the first thing that comes into his mind. Yeah, he'll say, Leaping Buffalo or something. He'll say, "Oh, Leaping Buffalo." But that really isn't the name. They consider that quite a joke. But the names, they're still that way with names, the Navajo and the Apache.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.